is Jimmy Clitheroe as the Clitheroe Kid, with Peter St. Clair, Patricia Burke...
A little
Danny
funny
Marsh,
man,
and
wasn't he? Yes, and very rum. He used to be in Blackpool, didn't he?
But yes. He was in Lancashire, weren't he?
That's Jimmy Clitheroe, little lad.
Yes, he was only little. He was Jimmy Clitheroe, yes, he was good.
Little, wasn't he?
He was only a little bloke, wasn't he? You remember him, don't you, Annie? Jimmy Clitheroe?
Yeah.
I thought he was always all right. Jimmy was.
Here is Jimmy Clitheroe as the Clitheroe Kid with Peter Sinclair.
Oh, God, how long has he been dead?
19 years.
Ah, oh, he must have been.
Oh, God, yeah.
Jimmy Clitheroe, yes.
Oh.
He's dead long ago, hasn't he?
Oh, yeah, he's been dead ages.
Well, he's been dead a long time, hasn't he? That's it, you got something there. He wasn't smutty.
We present Jimmy Clitheroe as the Clitheroe Kid with Peter Sinclair, Patricia Burke, Danny Ross.
You only have to look at him and you laugh.
Very good. Oh, God, well, very good he was.
He was part of Blackpool at one time. Because he lived not far from us on Bispham Road. Oh, he was. He was important. Yes, we like Jimmy Clitheroe.
Danny Ross and Diana Day in...
Any more for the beach?
This is Blackpool, the mecca of northern comic entertainers of the past. Frank Randall, George Formby, Dave Morris, Al Reed, Harry Corris, Hilda Baker, Thora Hurd, Arthur Askey. The list stretches as long as the Golden Mile. And shortest, but by no means least, Jimmy Clitheroe, our Jimmy. Adopted by every generous-hearted mum who ever dipped a toe in the sea and rubbed her shivering nippers down and winkled sand out of their ears. And millions more who came here to laugh, on the piers, at the Winter Garden Pavilion, or at the Queen's and Grand Theatre. For here's where the Clitheroe Kid's theatrical career spanned five generations. From the 1930s, when he appeared as a tiny teenager, to his last show here on the North Pier in 1971, topping the bill with Freddie and the Dreamers. But for little Jimmy, there was a much wider audience. There were millions listening to him on the Light programme, a TV audience on ITV, and with the overseas listeners at the BBC, the biggest worldwide ratings of all time. And it was at the height of that success that Jimmy Clitheroe came to live here. Well, this is the home where Jimmy Clitheroe lived with his mum in Blackpool and where he died, 118 Bispham Road. It's on the busy road from Blackpool to Fleetwood. It's a rather unprepossessing semi-detached bungalow with two rather shabby dormers sticking out of the roof. By no stretch of the imagination could it be seen as the luxury home of a man who, I reckon, was earning in the 1960s today's equivalent of £500,000 a year.
Hello. Hello. I wondered if you knew that this was the house where Jimmy Clitheroe used to live.
We found one poster that advertised his shows.
It says, Mums, Dads, Lasses and Lads, he's here, Jimmy. And then the words of his surname spell out, C is the cowboy you've seen on TV. L is the laughter he brings, you'll agree. I is for innocence, don't be misled. T for the trouble he gets in instead. A is for the howlers he tells with such joy. E means he's everyone's favourite boy. I is the rascal who wins in the end. O stands for Ossie, his comical friend. E the enjoyment you'll get watching him, our own little laughable, lovable Jim.
Kept you waiting, Alfie, but I really wanted that bath.
I've been telling you that for a week.
Don't be so cheeky.
That's enough of that, Jimmy. Sit down, Susan, I'll get you a cup of tea. Is Grandad ready yet?
Yes, he's coming down now, Mother.
Hey, what are you putting the light on for? It's still daylight.
Because I want to look at my face in the mirror.
There's bravery for you, Alfie.
Dry up. Oh, that bathroom mirror, my lipstick's all crooked.
Nah, looks all right to me.
Of course, a lipstick's all right. It's a face that's crooked.
But everybody's favourite boy, the laughable, lovable Jim of show business, was a man cruelly constrained inside the body of a 4'2" child. Fully grown, the expression is a mockery for little Jimmy, he was the height of an average 7-year-old. And in this quirk of nature, his dad was 6 foot and his mum over 5, lay Jimmy Clitheroe's public success and private misery. BBC producer James Casey worked with Jimmy, as did Ronnie Hilton.
I've worked with dwarfs in pantomimes and things like that, but Jimmy wasn't a dwarf, as you know. He was a midget. Jimmy was perfectly proportioned in his size. He was a little man.
Being in show business, you know, you didn't think about it. It was just Jimmy Clitheroe was a little performer. Yeah. I mean, he's only one step removed from the circus where they wouldn't be bothered by the bearded lady and so on, you know. Well, we certainly weren't bothered about Jimmy Clitheroe being a midget.
I never thought anything about it at all, and I certainly don't think he had any sort of chip on his shoulder. He was just extremely well integrated.
Molly Sugden was Jimmy's mum on stage and on ITV.
He was like a very small man, and I say man advisedly. But that was a funny thing. On stage or in television, he became a little boy. He was a little boy. I reacted to him as a little boy. In fact, one director once said to me, "I'm so afraid one day you'll smack him."
I can remember one instance, for instance. Afterwards, I laughed about it. We're having a break during the rehearsal of the Clitheroe Kid. And he'd gone on the drums, banging away on the drums, like a kid. And I shouted over, I said, "Come on, get off the drums. What the hell are you doing? Let's get..." And I thought, wait a minute, it isn't a little boy. This is the star of the show I'm talking to. And just for a moment, I'd forgotten. And I thought, you know, no wonder the public accepted.
I mean, we did the normal things. We had a drink together and I would go into his dressing room and he would come into mine. But I never personally felt embarrassed, as you could be embarrassed with a man that size. But one incident I remember very well, when we were in Blackpool, and we decided amongst us all in the company that we ought to have a party, a get-together, a thrash, as we called it, at sometime in the month. And on one of these occasions, Jimmy was probably had one or two too many. And I said, well, you can stay here, Jimmy. Don't need to go back home, go back to the caravan. Stay in the house. Plenty of room in the house. So I said, oh, my mum might be worried. I said, don't worry. Your mum knows where you are. We'll get one of the boys to go and tell her where you are. So I took him up to a bedroom and I undressed him, apart from his pants and his little vest. And it was like undressing a little boy. And he was giggling all the time. And I said, now, is there anything else you want, Jimmy? Can I get you anything? He said, well, there's all those lovely girls downstairs. So I said, no, go on, go to sleep, Jimmy. But that was as close as a man can get to another man. But I felt paternal towards him. I felt as if I was taking care of him, and which I did.
James Robinson Clitheroe was the only child of two Lancashire weavers. He was born in Clitheroe, he didn't take his name from the town, and as a babe in arms came to live in Blacko, a village on the outskirts of Nelson.
He was very, very tiny, very tiny. And when he was going to school, I always remember Harry Blizzard used to carry him on his shoulders.
But Harry Blizzard was his mate, who was the same age.
Yes, but Harry Blizzard was about 6 times as big as him. He was so tiny.
Irene Roberts was a childhood friend and later became a sister figure to Jimmy Clitheroe.
I always remember my mother saying, you know, I used to wheel you out when Mrs. Clitheroe wheeled Jimmy out. She said, and I said to her one day, do you know, Mrs. Clitheroe, or Jimmy isn't getting any bigger? I said, what a stupid thing to say.
I used to play with Jimmy, cricket and football and that kind of thing.
Tommy Trafford, later a business partner of Jimmy's, was one of the school gang in Blackhoe.
He could run in and out of them without a lot of trouble.
Like underneath the legs?
Yeah, yeah. I remember when Jimmy put the pads on, you could only just see his head above the pads. They covered him all up.
And a lot of the bigger lads used to pick on him from time to time, but he always had an answer. If he couldn't use his weight or his fists, he used to nip them, and we used to call him the Little Nipper.
And he was quite a cheeky little chappie, you know, and we used to pick him up and throw him about, being a small child, you know. But his only way of getting away, he used to nip. He could nip really savage, you know, and he used to drop him, you know, that was his protection.
But right at the beginning, he was always coming to my house, knocking at the door, couldn't reach the handle, and saying, "Irene, will you come and help us to make a circus?" I said, "Oh, Jimmy, not again. Oh, yes, please, go on. Make us a circus." Because this was his ambition from the beginning. He always wanted to be on the stage. Kept saying he did. Because, you see, he couldn't do anything else. That was his vacation, because he couldn't do anything else, could he? He wasn't big enough.
It was an inspired choice, aided by circumstances in the form of the villagers Winston Metcalf, who took Jimmy under his wing and made him the star of his Sunday school productions.
And there was one part, they were in like a school, and the teacher were asking the children, you see, "Why were you late?" And one would say, "Well, I had to go and get some rhubarb." "What for?" And Jimmy just shouts out, "We put custard on ours." He were very good.
"I'm one of Robin Hood's bowmen in our school pageant next week. Don't move, Sheriff Sinclair, or with one arrow from me trusty bow, I'll cut through your sporran and separate you from your kilt."
He were full of life. We're full of life. He was full of life.
From there, a local amateur talent spotter, George Baker, seems to have launched Jimmy's career. His modest beginnings can be traced through the local newspaper, the Nelson Leader, tucked away in their News from the Districts column. For the 28th of August 1936, there was news of him playing the accordion and doing female impersonations in review at New Brighton and Sheffield. He was still only 14. The next summer, there's a picture of Master Jimmy Clitheroe in drummer boy uniform. He'd pass for a five-year-old, dwarfed by a huge busby half his size. His first local appearance in November 1937 warrants no fewer than 34 lines. His act is described as adding a touch of comedy when he plays his accordion, which looks as big as himself. Throughout his career, the "A's Little Jimmy" were not simply the indulgent noises adults make to a lovable, mischievous child. They carry the extra sentiment reserved for the unfortunate, the afflicted. And this was inextricably bound up, it seems to me, with his success. In the shows, the laughter sometimes has a forced quality, people trying that bit harder to make him feel comfortable, indulging him that bit more for pity's sake.
"But let's not be too hard on young Jim, eh? He's got his good side, you know."
"Really? Well, when's he going to show it?"
"Now then, Pat, he's not all that bad. He's very fond of his mother, for a start."
"I know, I was only joking."
"Well, he absolutely adored his mother, really, didn't he? I mean, he wouldn't have done anything. And really, I think his mother always sort of told him that he was, you know, a bit of a freak of nature."
This is Diana Day, Jimmy Clitheroe's radio sister Susan.
"That he wasn't normal, and so I think he had a bit of a hang-up there about it. He was always such a careful person with his money and everything, you know, because I think his mother instilled it that he had to be."
Did you get an impression that she was domineering, though?
"Oh, yes, yes. Quite overpowering at times, you know."
They were totally tied to each other.
Jim Casey, son of comedian Jimmy James, and later to become Jimmy Clitheroe's producer and scriptwriter.
And she was a small woman, I suppose 5 feet one or something like that, and a typical northern, sort of Coronation Street-ish type woman. You know, being very careful with the housekeeping and so on.
Right, don't bother to bring any money. I'll borrow some off me grandad.
I mean, Jim was a little bit tight with money, and his mother was even tighter, so she kind of encouraged this. I mean, she almost defied him to spend any money on her or anything. I can remember once I went to see him at Filey, and his mother came in, soaked to the skin. And I mean, he was top of the bill, and he was earning probably £600 a week, you know. He lived in a caravan with his mother, just the two of them, and she had come in, and she was soaked. And he said, oh, what did you come out for, Mum? She said, well, I wanted to come round. And I said to him, you know, being a bit sarcastic, I said, you know, you want to try that new American invention? I said, it's a marvellous thing. It's called a taxi. And I said, they pick you up and they bring you here and they drop you off and you don't get wet at all. I said, they've got them in England now, you know. And he said, oh, well, she won't let me pay for a taxi. So she walked in the rain.
Jimmy's early individual performances on stage were as a stooge. It was also as a stooge that Jimmy Clitheroe's brief career in films began. In 1940, he had a bit part as stooge to Arthur Lucan in an Old Mother Riley film. And in 1942, he appeared with George Formby. But this wasn't Hollywood. The Old Mother Riley film was made at a Manchester studio, and the film career soon spluttered to an end. For the next 15 years, Jimmy performed the hard slog of the variety theatres.
Well, he was just a very good performer. And, I mean, he got laughs, and he got laughs with very simple comedy and purely, really, on his performance, on his timing. I mean, he'd come on and the conjurer would produce the egg out of the bag and then he'd get hold of the bag and turn it upside down and there's the egg in it, you know, and he just ruined the tricks.
Did you ever see him in a stage act where he was actually a ventriloquist dummy?
Yes, that was the other another thing he did. And although it went well, I always found it rather grotesque because he looked too much like a dummy, you know, being a midget with this set grin on his face. I mean, it was very good, very lifelike, but he looked really like a dummy and it wasn't very nice, I didn't think, to look at.
By now, Jim Casey was working with the BBC. Casey was looking for a little boy with the maturity and experience not to ruin his gags in the Northern Variety Parade show of his father, Jimmy James.
And Jim Casey, I think, was writing the show for his father, called The Mayor's Parlour, and he said, would you come up and do a bit in it? It was only a few lines, but and I came all the way from London to Manchester.
The expense. But Jimmy was perfect. From this came appearances in Norman Evans' Over the Garden Wall, then a series called Cowboy.
Well, we sort of worked, or Jim Casey, who was writing it, worked a little story into Cowboy, where every week we used to do a little domestic scene in the show.
And it was very successful. And a little while afterwards, I did a pilot of The Clitheroe Kid. Everybody liked it, except the Headlight programme. And he didn't want a midget on radio, he said. So I said, well, they don't actually know he is, you know, being radio, because he sounds like a boy. He said, yes, but I know, and I don't like it. So we did another two series of Cowboy. But the third one, I was in the BBC by then, and I produced it. And when we had the next meeting, I was waiting at the door, and I said, Cowboy figures, fantastic. He said, yes. I said, the best they've ever had. He said, yes. I said, the reason is Jimmy Clitheroe at home playing a little boy in a 7-minute sketch. Now can I do the Clitheroe Kid? And so in the end, he said, yes, do six.
Well, it was a start at least.
We present Jimmy Clitheroe as the Clitheroe Kid with Peter Sinclair, Patricia Burke, Danny Ross and Diana Day in
100 Not Out.
Yes, ladies and gentlemen, the Clitheroe Kid is 100 programmes old today. And in this special edition, we invite you...
Jimmy Clitheroe's radio career as the Clitheroe Kid gave him the perfect opportunity to escape from the cruel handicap of his size. It gave him the chance to be normal, to be an eternal boy, to reverse the cruel process of ageing without growing. No wonder he came alive when a radio script was put in his hands. No wonder he perked up, effervesced. He'd escaped completely from the painful reality of the grown-up man trapped inside a child's body. He was just the kid himself, our Jimmy.
Right, Mum, what is it you want?
Would you go and call Susan, please?
Certainly. What shall I call her, Fishface?
I think he did and said things that we would probably all like to do ourselves, but couldn't get away with it, but he could.
Enter Fishface, alias Scraggy Neck, alias Diana Day. For Diana and the cast, Sunday was recording day at the Hume Hippodrome in Manchester, sharing the audience for the afternoon session with singer Ronnie Hilton. Mornings were reserved for rehearsals and high jinks.
But when he, Danny and I got together, we used to get the most uncontrollable laughs. How Jim Casey put up with us at times, I'll never know. One time we laughed so much, he actually had to say, stop, we'll go for a tea break, you know. And then you know what it's like to get past that point again where you've started laughing. The scripts would be going again. You think, of course, it changed a lot over the years. In the first years, we always used to share half of the show with other people, you know, like Ronnie Hilton.
Well, it was a kind of show that I wasn't used to. I was used to just walking on in front of the band and singing songs, whereas Jimmy's show was a number of actors or actresses stood around with various scripts and little Jimmy with his own little microphone down in the middle of them all. I have a feeling that he always wore his schoolboy outfit even though it was recorded broadcasts.
We used to sort of, you know, quite work it as much as we could, you know. I mean, Danny Ross would... He would do his famous fall, very often fall flat, you know, trip over a wire on the stage and... Oh, it was most important, yes. He couldn't have done it without his shorts and his cap, I'm sure. I did a couple of shows, you know, when I was very pregnant. Can you imagine that? Which was terribly funny, you know, being round the mic, you know. And they would call the baby, the future baby, sort of Fred Bloggs, Danny and Jimmy. And, of course, you know, how's Fred today? It must have looked so funny, really, from the audience's point of view, this pregnant woman.
Playing the 17-year-old
sister. Yes!
It's hard to account these days for the staggering popularity of the Clitheroe Kid. It was full of baffling incongruities. No dad, but a Scottish granddad. A sister who spoke ever so posh and seemed to have been educated on another planet from the others. But with a boyfriend in Alfie Hall... who made the proverbial two short planks look razor sharp. But its appeal was huge. Perhaps the audience were still innocent before the welter of TV domestic sitcoms hit us and made us weary of seeing our domestic lives in so many different mirrors. My 8-year-old boy was fascinated by hearing some of the episodes. It's really good, he told me, because it's simple. I like the simpleness of it. Whatever the trick, Jimmy was a big success, with nearly a quarter of the population switching on each Sunday lunchtime. Molly Sugden.
Whilst anybody who knew Jimmy never felt that he was a little person, I think when he walked about the streets, it couldn't be avoided. And people would come up to him. And, I mean, it's a bit of a smothering experience if people keep coming up and grabbing your arm and holding you around the waist. And you think, oh, get off, you know, please, say hello, but don't keep pawing me.
I do remember one incident in Blackpool when that happened. You know, when you're walking down the street in Blackpool and people recognise you, they don't just stop you and say, can I have your autograph? They grab you, they get hold of you and say, oh, look, and I remember what happened to him. A very large black lady, and he said she was like the typical, hello there, a mama, you know, and she had a head tied in a scarf around her head, and she said... Is you that Jimmy Clitheroe? And he said, yeah. Boy, you make me laugh. And he said, it was like a scene from a film. And she shook him.
Jimmy
he had tremendous control. I can remember once, when I say people didn't say nasty things, the only one who ever said anything, it was a BBC canteen lady who thought she was being funny and I suppose thought he would think it was funny. But he pushed his plate back when we were getting our food and he said, oh, could you take some off, as I only like a small portion. And she said, oh, go on, eat it up, it'll make you grow. Well, every one of us just froze. But Jim just sort of dismissed it. He just said, oh, OK, and walked away. And I was furious, you know. And then I thought, but this woman isn't being nasty, actually. She thinks it's funny and she likes him. But he just took that and didn't get upset or angry. I mean, inside he may have been, but I think he was physically afraid of people as well. Somebody in a club poured a drink over his head or something. And apparently he was quite frightened in case the man had hit him or something. I think he felt secure with us, the crowd we were in the show.
Everyone who knew Jimmy seems to be able to tell a story of his being stopped in his car by the police. And there were the wary publicans worried about selling intoxicating liquor to minors, and tram conductors who thought he should pay half fare. But nowhere is the adult world more poignantly seen to be beyond little Jimmy's reach than in the picture painted by Ronnie Hilton. The scene is the Queen's Theatre in Blackpool. Topping the bill with Jimmy is Ronnie and Dickie Henderson.
Dickie's dressing room was in the corner, mine was in the opposite side, and then Jimmy's was opposite to mine. And none of us closed our doors. If I found a thought of a gag, I would tell him going in, and he would do the same thing to me. And the dancers were all upstairs. And I would love to have known him better than I did, but it was one of those situations. He went home to his mum, or with his mum. He was sort of disappeared after the show.
You get the picture of those robust, thoroughly normal male adults after the show, the bar calling, the dancing girls upstairs, and Jimmy excluded, his mother hovering around ready to whisk him back home to Bispham Road to his hot cocoa and cold bed sheets. Well, almost.
I used to see him in the garden, yeah. I heard about that bit. Funny little thing he was.
Mary Watkinson's house overlooks the back garden at 118 Bispham Road.
Well, his mother was quite old. I think much older than I am, and I'm 80. She was much older than I was. When I remember his mother, she used to walk with a stick and come down the garden, and he used to grow all his vegetables down at the bottom of the garden. He used to come down and steal the peas, and she used to come out with a stick. He was definitely under. He built, on the back of that bungalow, he built a large, like a conservatory type. You can't see for the trees in the wintertime. You can see right across his house. He used to have that like a little sports place, have his pals in to play billiards and whatever they play in those kind of places.
Tommy Trafford was a frequent visitor to Bispham Road.
He was a snooker fan. He was never away from the pub, the Squirrel, in Blackpool. And he was very, very interested in horse racing. He had his own Jet Plus, they called it, his horse. Yeah, but no, until he really made it, he was very, very nice to know. Once he got there, he altered. He didn't trust anybody. And they were all trying to do him out of this great wealth.
By now, the mid-60s, Jimmy was earning a lot of money. On radio, the Clitheroe Kid was breaking records for audience ratings. He was topping the bill in summer shows and pantomime. And he had a regional TV series with independent ABC television. He doesn't appear to have been able to leave television alone. Not content to have the perfect medium, radio, to easily and willingly suspend public disbelief that here was a man fast approaching middle age playing the part of a 12-year-old boy, he must court TV with its cruelly revealing studio lights and remorselessly probing cameras.
One of Jimmy's problems was it was the money that mattered. Spending the minimum, always. And I said to him, I said, if you want new sketches, I said, you book the grandfather, you book Danny Ross, in the summer season. I said, you can have 3 new sketches tomorrow that will go like a bomb with them in it. But they will want paying. Money dominated his life, really. And in a way, it was his problem and it was a drawback in his career. I mean, I can remember him saying to me once, he had a pantomime. He said, oh, it's terrible, the script is terrible. And I thought, he probably wants me to rewrite the script for nothing. I said, well, why are you doing it? You did a pantomime last year, it was very good. And you could have done the same pantomime this year somewhere else. Now, he didn't like the producer and he thought the script was terrible. But he was doing it because they were offering him £100 more.
So he was dead mean. Yeah, he was. A nice lad, but no. Well, we went to buy a hotel, which he was keen to have. And anyway, I knocked him down from 17,000 to 10,000. And he says, you've done right well for me today. Don't you worry, I'll see you right. And he bought me a 20 packet of fags. I mean, it was stupid. He would have all cut glass and everything of the best, you know, which was a waste of money.
One of his greatest pleasures, I remember him telling me, was the fact that he had a room where everything was electric and he could sit in the chair and press a button and the curtains would close. I thought, well...
It was beautiful. Gorgeous. Because that room, that bedroom, cost a heck of a lot, 7,000 or 8,000 just for that room. Then, the door was black leather, studded with brass. The bed, you know, it used to go up and down. It was all electrically controlled. And when you were in bed, you could switch a button and a bar would come out. And you switch a button on the left and a screen would come down. They could show films. It was lavish, very lavish.
This was Jimmy and his fads. Yeah, I think he slept on it once.
Why did he spend so lavishly on it when he was fairly tight otherwise?
That was always a surprise to me. But I wondered if it was her.
Her was a girl called Sally.
You see, he had that girl, you know. Sally, did you know that?
Was Sally beautiful?
No. No, she wasn't beautiful, no.
But she'd been a tiller girl.
Oh, yeah. She was nicely made. She was tall and slim and smart. But I wouldn't say she was beautiful.
What do you think she saw in him?
Well, what they all see in money. But I always used to think that, and Mrs. Clitheroe definitely thought that.
There was a lot more in it than what people realised. Sally was like a sort of secretary, but she kind of did everything for him, you know, drove the car, because he used to get very, very bored at being stopped by the police. And when he first tells you this, you know, it used to be funny, but really and truly, he did get awfully fed up with it.
And what became of Sally?
Oh, it was terribly sad. She died in a car crash.
The day she died, I was at the hotel. She says, I'm fed up with him. And I said, oh, dear, whatever's the matter, you know. They were invited to this party, Val Dunican and Arthur Askey. And she had gone to have her hair done and get a new dress. But in the meantime, while she was away, somebody had rung him up and invited him to go with him. And this is showbiz. That might lead him to a show. But he could have taken her with him, but he didn't, you see. And she was mad at that. And she went to Chapman, where she lived, and killed herself.
She had an accident in the car, didn't she?
Yeah. But she was in a terrible state when she went.
So was it a stormy sort of relationship, theirs?
Well, it's forced to be. Yes, I should think so. I think the mother would interfere. And I knew the mother didn't agree.
In your estimation, was he capable of having any kind of relationship with a woman?
No, how could he? And his mother, when Sally came on the scene, I suppose she got pushed aside, I don't know.
I think he wanted very much to marry her, but his mother didn't approve. And really, he wouldn't do anything if his mother didn't approve. He really wouldn't do it. And she didn't approve. It was a bit sad, really, isn't it?
In August 1972, the last Clitheroe Kid was broadcast. The series had run for over 14 years, but the audience figures had slumped from 10.5 million to just 1 million, so the BBC decided to end it. Sally had been killed in a car crash after a terrible row with Jimmy, and in the following year, Jimmy's mother died. Within 12 months, the mainstays of Jimmy Clitheroe's life had collapsed. On the day of his mother's funeral, the 6th of June 1973, Jimmy was found dead at their Blackpool home. All the national newspapers at the time put his age at about 57. He was, in fact, 51. All his life he'd been secretive about his age. When you live by the illusion of eternal youth, every passing year is a nail in the coffin of that illusion. Jimmy clung to the illusion to the very end. There was an inquest into his death, and the coroner recorded a verdict of accidental death due to the combined toxic effects of barbiturates and alcohol. I suggest that a certain respectable gloss may have been applied to that odd notion of an accidental overdose. After all, this is Blackpool, mecca of carefree fun, and Jimmy Clitheroe was one of its demigods. There may have been more intent behind the accident than people cared to admit.
I don't think so. I don't know, but I don't think so. I think he just took sleeping tablets and then he drinks. And I mean, he was very depressed and terribly, terribly shattered with his mother's death and probably drank quite a bit and then took more tablets without realising it, I think. In a way, I don't think Jim would have had the courage to actually decide to kill himself. But I can understand that life would have been very bleak for him without his mother, because she was the most important thing in his life.
And he was on his own, wasn't he? And he'd always had his mother there. Everywhere they went, his mother was there. He had a rotten life, really, I should say. I'll tell you what he told me. He says, "Do you know, Irene, I feel awful." I said, "Do you?" He said, "Yes, and when I get on that stage and the curtain goes up and the orchestra starts, I come alive. I forget everything else and I live it."
I suppose, you see, as a midget, the great thing with him, instead of just being a midget who would be dismissed, he was a star. I mean, it was everything. Other than that, he would have been just a funny little midget. But he was Jimmy Clitheroe, and can I have your autograph?
Those involved with the Clitheroe Kid this week were Peter Sinclair as grandfather, Patricia Burke as mother, Danny Ross as Alfie Hall, and Diana Day as Susan. The recorded programme was written by James Casey and Frank Roscoe, produced by James Casey, and starred Jimmy Clitheroe as the Kid himself.
A programme all about me. I've really enjoyed telling you all these stories, and you might be interested to know that up to date, I've had 34 spankings, washed my neck 6 times, and eaten 500 weight of whipped cream walnuts. See you next week. Ta-ra!